Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
the zombie myths of Australian military history. And look, I must admit, it's sometimes with a bit of guilt, shock, fascination, education, that I read through this, because this sort of stuff isn't the main fare of stuff that you're served up at ceremonies, commemorations, or people's tend to tell you stories that reinforce the myth rather than refute the myths. So the myths so far have been two fairly, I think, simple myths. Three simple myths. One is about British occupation of the land and sort of the impact of that particular myth. So it's sort of a nuanced thing. Then there's Breaker Morant, which is about the Boer War and Imperial War, the First World War. And the third one is about the First World War, which is very much an empire army. You know, we form part of an empire army, and sort of in this process we sort of began to wean ourselves from the British Empire. So that's an important point. So, but that process is obviously subject of massive myth writing. And the Gallipoli campaign is interesting to look at because strategically it's impossible, and historically it's a point of the war where no one had learnt how to actually fight World War One. They only learnt how to fight World War One after 4 years. So everything was a stalemate. But I suppose on reflection, Gallipoli was a lesson that was taught to Australians, and it translated into a training regime to do various operations, but also into all amphibious landings, which is Normandy and a series of Australian amphibious landings against the Japanese in World War II, all use lessons. So it's very much studied military failure in most military schools. So rather, so as we're off studying it or being lullabied, it's a lullaby to us, the Australian people. It's an abject history lesson, which is taught in all the military schools around the world. So this, we've got somewhere with it. The next one is Australians broke the Hindenburg line. So let's, what I'll do is give you some indication. So Hindenburg was a German general, and he devised a basic structure, realizing that the Germans were overstretched fighting the Europeans and the French and the Russians at the same time. So they basically devised this very strong defensive fortification called the Hindenburg Line, stretching all across the Western Front, and with lots of resources, concrete, well-designed bunkers. Basically, they had military theory on their side, whereas the West had politicians. This is running it. So it was the number of kilometres gained in the front on the invasion, whereas the Germans looked at the high features and basically structured their features such that they could walk away from the Western Front, beat the Russians, and then come back and then beat the French, which is the general plan. So the Hindenburg Line was an essential feature to actually just sort of stop the war, allow them to fight the war with fewer troops, bring them across to the Russians, beat the Russians. Then they came back, and it was an absolute nightmare for a while in 1918, the Germans were just suddenly much more massive because they'd beaten the Russians, so they could take all their Russian units across to the Western Front, and they had a window of opportunity to beat the living daylights out of everyone. And then the Americans and Canadians began to enter the war, and things turned, and the general, as we've learnt from Gallipoli, it was a general training. People were trained in, Australians were trained in trench warfare, how to go through their different methods, coordination, logistics, and while Russia was starving, the quality of shells, number of shells came up, and you have your classic situation there. So the war evolved, and the Hindenburg line broke. Now, the entire point of the Hindenburg line is that it allowed fewer Germans to exert battlefield superiority. It's a very extensive thing to do. So if you could break the Hindenburg line, you would be able to win the war, and they did. Once Hindenburg line won, the subsequent field fighting the war without the Hindenburg line was largely impossible. But similar to Gallipoli, there was basically a bit like boxing. The Germans had armies in reserve, so if there was a breach, they could move the army up. But if you had simultaneous attacks at different points, they would have nothing to do with that. They couldn't block both things, so you've got feints and stuff like that. It's interesting about Lone Pine was not a military objective. It was not a legitimate military objective with a strategic goal. It was basically a feint or a diversion. Of course, Australians took this and had a massive loss of life, so they didn't really understand it was a feint, and they weren't supposed to actually really hurt themselves doing it too much. Of course, you don't tell the truth. Your job is to go. You're not expected to win. You're expected to divert them and draw the enemy in, because you want them focused at this point in time. So that's the Hindenburg line, and what had happened is that the British units could be filled by anyone from anything in the British Isles, whereas the Australian units were slightly more highly paid. They were volunteers, not conscripts, and they had they were rotated out of the front, and they had fought at Gallipoli. So the knowledge there was to very much train them, and so the Australian troops were very much trained up, selected as the best people, and they broke a section of the Hindenburg line. But you can see this story is, oh, it's a great thing. The Australians pushed back huge amounts of territory, simply because I don't think they were as war-weary as the other combatants. They had a combination of experience and naivety, this combination, which meant that they were integral in taking various German things. But it's also interesting to remember that during the war, everyone had their own barrier to push, and so there was this cacophony of, we won the war, and of course you would be able to hear it. And what's happened is that as we've entered Australia, we've lost the... This is a wrap up so far. I better put you into the picture of the geography of these things. The first Australian campaign was west of Istanbul and on the Mediterranean approach to Turkey and the Dardanelles, and there was an operation there which failed. Then the Australians hung around the Western Front, which is in the sort of, if you catch the train from Amsterdam to Paris, you go right through the battlefields there of the Somme and that area there. That's the Western Front, the heavy fighting in the Western Front. That's fighting Belgium and stuff like that was there. I should also mention the sort of terrible cost of the Hindenburg line. So the Australians were facing the Hindenburg line. The Germans had overextended themselves, breaching the the Hindenburg Line once they had the success there. And then they were pushed back to the Hindenburg Line, and it had to be broken to end World War One. It would have just carried on. And there's other factors, I suppose, like the fact that the Germans were effectively blockaded, and so the German Empire machine was falling apart at the stage when the Hindenburg Line failed. An important aspect of the Hindenburg Line is that it was a military zone, and one of the things they do in military zones is remove all civilians. If you have civilians in a military zone, it's hard. You have to think short before you shoot. And so they effectively evacuated all the Belgians and everyone from the Hindenburg Line to go ahead. And they burnt all the civilian buildings. So any building there the Germans knew about and could blow up. It's impossible to go about. And that's very similar to when the Japanese took Singapore. The military zone ahead of Singapore, they just removed all the villages, removed all the people. Having civilians there obviously is a security risk, an intelligence risk, so it was just practice at the time. So you just get a picture of what the Hindenburg Line is like. Now, one of the legends we have is the Australians broke the Hindenburg Line, and I know for a fact that we did break sections of the Hindenburg Line. There was other factors, other things going on. I think other units also broke the Hindenburg Line. We broke it at a very heavily fortified key point, but there were other units which also broke it at all pretty much at the same time. But this is a zombie legend. Australians firmly believe, they don't believe anybody else was involved in it. Similar to whether Australians or Canadians shot down the Red Baron, sort of Canadians claim it, and then Australians claim it. Okay, World War One has given, this is by Elizabeth Greenhull. World War One has given rise to some of the most deeply seated myths and most resilient zombies of Australian military history. Most of them, to some extent, have their roots in the idea of the ANZAC, Australian and New Zealand Army Corps, and the uniqueness of that concept bestowed upon Australian soldiers fighting in the war. C.E.W. Beans, official account, defines the concept of ANZAC as standing for reckless valour and a good cause, for enterprise, resourcefulness, fidelity, comradeship, and endurance. So Bean is an often quoted historian in the war memorials, but he's just a propaganda machine. Since then, images of bronze, indomitable ANZAC infantrymen have dominated the pages of popular works. Of course, much of what was written at the time about the Australian Imperial Force was clearly propaganda. They are great soldiers, the Australians, with keen, clear-cut falcon faces, and there is a reckless daredevilry combined with a spice of cunning which gives them a place of their own in the Imperial ranks. Here's another quote. Intolerant of restraint, with no respect for rank or caste unless it has carried strength with it. Eternally lively, forthright, sensitive, and cavalier-like. Now, I must admit, I don't know whether this legend preceded us, encouraged Australians to act like this, or Australians are a bit like this. English people think that we're slightly more like this. Sometimes we're sort of painfully arrogant and stupid. The idea that the Australian volunteers had developed specifically Australian racial characteristics well suited the modern industrial war, in contrast to the class-ridden, stunted, conscripted infantry of the mother country, is quite ridiculous. At least one-fifth of those men had been born in the United Kingdom. So our Aussies were out here, a fifth of them were immigrants. Nonetheless, the notion of ANZAC as a unique defining characteristic of Australian servicemen and an explanation of battlefield success took special significance on the Western Front in 1918. Here, instead of participating in an ill-fated invasion of Turkish territory, the Anzacs expelled the German invaders from France and Belgium. The dominant English language historiographical tradition regards the final stages of World War I tends to forget the battlefield victories of the Entente, Entente allies in 1918. So, Entente, I have never seen that word before. It's E-N-T-E-N-T-E. I don't know what that means. Such successes are often swamped by whiter images of British butcher generals and military incompetence. In the studies of 1918, particular emphasis is usually placed on the stunning German success in its march on April 1918, when the Fifth Army was almost wiped out. The latter so-called 100 days between the Battle of Amiens that began on the 8th of August 1918 and the armistice signed on the 11th of November are neglected. Okay. The spearhead of the operations during those months in August and November was the 4th Army of Sir General Henry Rawlinson. It included Australian Corps and Canadian Corps. Compared to the poor reputation of the British Expeditionary Force, especially its Commander-in-Chief, Sir Douglas Haig, the perceived performance of the colonial Dominion troops has gained importance as the years have progressed and has served as a stick with which to beat the British. Furthermore, breaching the Hindenburg Line at the end of September 1918 led to the commander of the German generals, the German forces, General Erich Ludendorff, strictly speaking, Quartermaster General, and its Field Marshal Paul von Hindenburg was commander-in-chief, that Lindenburg was effectively in charge, to declare to his general staff the final defeat was inescapable. Only a quick end to the war would save the army from annihilation. Liberal socialist politicians were saddled with the task of ending the war. The condition of circumstances, benefit of a favourable comparison with the British army, of which it was a small part, the glory of driving the German army commander to propose an armistice to end their war has led to some extravagant claims that the Australian Corps, for the Australian Corps. Its commander, General Sir John Manash, wrote to the Minister of Defence, George Pearce, that he strongly believed that the Corps was the, quote, dominating factor in, quote, forcing the enemy out of the Hindenburg Line in a situation which was compelling to him to sue for peace. I am quite aware that other troops in the Imperial Force helped materially in all of this, but I am able to assert, without contradiction, that the performance of the Australian Corps far transcends the performance of any similar body of troops on the Western Front. Okay, that's probably a load of rot. So this is the... Look, there was... Everyone wrote. Like, it's not... You don't have everyone said their group was the best. A recent biographer goes so far as to give his work the subtitle The Outsider Who Won the War. This chapter examines the performance of Monash and his Australian Corps in the operation that broke the Hindenburg Line at the end of September 1918. September, October, November. So it's only a month after, a month or so, where those extravagant claims are justified. So this is the entire thing. It's like the ozone layer is more than a layer. The Hindenburg line is more than a line, it says. It was a fearsome succession of very strong defensive positions running from the Belgian coast to the German frontier. Named for the German commander-in-chief, its construction began when Hindenburg and Ludendorff were appointed to supreme command in the west. Both men had directed the war in the east until September 1916. When they replaced General Ich von Falkenhayn. On their first visit to France, they were appalled by the Prince Rupert of Bavaria told them about the very different conditions of fighting on the Western Front, where the Battle of the Somme was in progress. They decided changes had to be made, hence the decision was taken to construct the Hindenburg Line, as the Allies came to call the defensive system. So the Germans didn't call it the... they were fighting sort of fairly fluid war, you know, war against the Russians. Here, they were just blasting each other across. So, 1916, September 16, is the Somme, just the most stupid blast fest and killing everything, they decided we're not going to do that. It's been interesting that the Germans had a solution to not doing World War One. It's consisted of five sections named after the heroes of the German legend. Wotan extended from the coast of Arras in northern France. Siegfried Seelug fortified zone was the first to be built and the strongest. It extended from Arras to Soissons into the French zone. Thus, it was the Siegfried that faced the 4th Army in 1918, which is the Aussies. Next, the Albrecht linked Soissons and Lyon, and Brunhilde ran from Lyon across the Champagne area in France. Finally, Kriemhild, which I think is the Valkyrie wife of another person, I'm not quite sure. I read the legend a long time ago. It was really good. But if you read the original legend, it's just impossible. You can read the Wagnerian one, that's readable, but if you read the Ring of the Nibelung, it's called, it's just, I can read ancient Latin, okay, but German tales are just do your head in. Okay, extend behind Argonne as far as Metz, which is then German Lorraine, although it was incomplete at the time of the armistice. So they're still not doing it. So it gives you an idea that the front was a variable thing. The Hindenburg line was not only long, extending across the whole of northern France, it was also deep. A thinly held outpost zone about 500 metres deep, constructed where possible along the... A thinly held outpost zone about 500 metres deep, constructed where possible along the crests of any high ground, gave the main body of defenders time to deal with any enemy troops who broke through. Next, the main battle zone was constructed on a reverse slope, hence not directly observable. It consisted of two, later three or four deep trench lines reinforced by concrete and steel pillboxes, whose defenders poured machine gun fire over the intervening areas. Constantine wire, piled up to a height of 2 meters in some in places, extended the main battle zone to a depth of 1.5 to 2 kilometers. Natural features such as canals, waterways were incorporated into the defensive scheme. Behind this battle zone and out of reach of the enemy artillery, troops were held in ready in reserve line to deal with any breach. With such defensive depth, it was always possible to use forced labour to build extra lines of trenches, even during a battle, should it become necessary. Germans began to withdraw to the Siegfried line, Siegfried-Seelug line, in February 1917, in order to block the French and British offences planned in April. Hindenburg and Ludendorff wanted to be free to concentrate in 1917 in defeating the Russians, and hoped that their submarine offensive would be enough to starve the Entente allies into requesting an armistice. There was no need to mount a land offensive in the west. The withdrawal was carried out quite ruthlessly, as the Germans destroyed all villages in the zone between their front at the end of the Battle of the Somme and their new shorter defensive position. They blew up roads and booby-trapped ruins. They cut down trees and transported the population. It was a highly successful tactic. It shortened the German line, freed up 13 German divisions, and the scorched earth policy meant that the Allies could not make a swift pursuit. Most importantly, it confounded the current French plans for an offensive. In 1918, after the Russians had left the war, and after the submarine offensive had obviously failed, Ludendorff decided that he had to defeat the Allies in the field in the Western Front, before the new American troops could be brought across the Atlantic, equipped and trained. Peace with Russia meant the German troops could move by train to France, where they would have temporary numerical superiorities until the Americans arrived in greater numbers. In five powerful offensives, the first two against the British lines in northern France and Belgium, the last three against the French lines further east, German troops left the Hindenburg line far behind them
as they captured enormous, in the Western Front terms, tracts of territory from the Allies. However, the tide turned in July 1918 when General Ferdinand Foch launched the first counterattack against the overextended, badly supplied enemy. Foch was now supreme commander in the West, coordinating the Belgian, British, French, American, and Italian troops. He began a series of offensives at time to create maximum damage and keep the Germans on the back foot. By September, the Germans had been pushed back to the and found themselves once again in the original Hindenburg Line positions. The Australians had taken part in the Battle of Amiens that began on the 8th of August, and so had developed and helped drive the enemy back to the Hindenburg Line, along with the other units of the 4th Army, Canadian Corps and the British 3rd and 4th Corps. Now they fought as an Australian formation. Five divisions of Australian Imperial Force had been collected together as a corps back in May, and Monash had been appointed to command it. It was Monash who subsequently drew up the plan for the main attack against the Siegfried section of the Hindenburg Line. So, as there were different sections, the Siegfried lines. The German defences facing the 4th Army were immensely strong. The main battle zone incorporated a deep canal, the Saint-Quentin Canal, that linked Somme and Scheveld rivers, and was both wide and steep-sided. This made it impossible to deploy tanks to help the infantry in this sector. In the northern sector of the army front, the canal ran into a tunnel. This made a physical crossing of the battle zone easier. But the artillery-proof tunnel provided shelter for medical facilities and for enemy troops. The defences of the outpost line were made even stronger to compensate for the lack of water barrier at this point. The triple line of trenches in this zone was well wide and supported by dugouts and concrete pillboxes and a further support line. Well behind the main battle zone, a reserve line was in process of construction. In front of the battle zone, on the ridge line above the canal, the outposts consisted a machine gun post strengthened by dugouts and wires. Although still named an outpost line, it had been fortified so much that it had become, in fact, the equivalent to another main battle zone. In addition, the Germans had taken over three lines of old British trenches that had once faced the Hindenburg Line in 1917. As a consequence of this, I can't believe that it's about... We're talking about 12 trenches deep. As a consequence, the 4th Army and the Australian faced three lines of wires and trenches plus fortified outpost lines on the crest before they reached the strong main position with the tunnel and the canal. And there was still a further reserve line after that. All in all, six lines to deal with before they reached open country. By early September 1918, the Allied successes in pushing the Germans back to the Hindenburg defences encouraged Foch to believe that there was a chance to end the war in 1918 instead of 1919, as most everyone had assumed would be the case. The French counterstroke on Marne in July and the British offensive out of Amiens had been followed by a successful American operation that cleared Saint-Mihiel salient in the eastern France. Therefore, Foch drew up a coordinated plan that would produce a series of sequence blows against the enemy front all the way from the channel to Mietz in the east. These blows would have an effect of squeezing the German held territory in France because the attacks would converge and force the Germans to retire back to the Rhine River. Hence, Foch created the Northern Army Group, the Flanders Army Group, under the command of the King of the Belgians and containing the British Second Army. These armies were to drive into Belgium on the 28th of September. Before that, Haig's 1st and 3rd Armies would attack towards Cambrai on the 27th of September and joined the French-American attacks in Meuse-Argonne and will begin a series on the 26th of September. The joint British 4th Army and French 1st Army pushed towards Saint-Quentin was to be the last in a series beginning on the 29th of September. There's no chance the Germans' reserves could be rushed to the Siegfried line after such a wildly spaced successive attacks. So, essentially, the Germans had a reserve, and the Australians didn't have to worry about the reserve because these attacks were going on either side. So, in proper context, the Australian Corps attack on the outposts of the main lines, the secret disturbed lines, should be viewed as part of a huge plan to finish off the enemy once and for all, as a sequence of attacks along the whole Western Front. The Siegfried position was indeed formidable. By 1918, the Allies had weapons systems capable of dealing with such defences. Infantry had now a range of trench weapons, Lewis guns and mortars. I don't know exactly what a Lewis gun is. To help cross no man lands. Aircraft and tanks now supported their attacks. Guns, both field artillery and heavies, had seemingly unlimited supply of shells and could be fired with much greater accuracy than had been the case in the earlier years of the war. Furthermore, Monash had at his own disposal a captured map from the Hindenburg Line's defences, an invaluable document with which to inform his planning process. Nevertheless, this portion of the Hindenburg Line, facing the Fourth Army and the Australians, the Siegfried Stedel Line, Stedelung, was still too strong, too deep to be taken in one operation. Consequently, its capture was divided into two stages. The first would be take the old British lines of trenches and then the outpost line. The first stage would give the British observation of the main battle zone along the line of the canal into the tunnel. The second stage of operation would follow in a few days later and complete the capture of the whole defensive system. If Rawlson was to keep Foch's timetable, and the plan depended on rapid succession of attacks, whereby the main attack was launched on the 29th of September, then the preliminary operation to capture the outpost line as a jumping-off point had to be achieved quickly. Despite general fatigue, Fourth Army had pursued the enemy to the Hindenburg Line without let-up since Amiens on the 8th of August. The attack on the outpost line began on the 18th of September with the Australian Corps at the centre of the front. The 1st and 4th Australian Divisions were used to attack and given added firepower with the allocation of machine guns from the 3rd and 5th Division. Thus, 250 machine gunners provided a powerful barrage ahead of the advancing infantry, in addition to the 4th Army's heavy guns carrying out counter-battery work. After an early morning start in mist, the Australian Division had captured the objectives, and by 10 a.m, the three former British trench liners were and the German outpost line. After dark, in its second attempt, the 4th Division followed suit. The success of the Australian Division contrasted the failure on their flanks. To the north, the British 3rd Corps faced particularly strong defences and had been given a complicated barrage plan to follow. To the south, the 9th Corps was handicapped by the failure of the French unit to fire a supporting barrage, leaving the attacking British formations without covering fire. The contrast between the success of the Australian Corps and the failures of the 3rd and 9th Corps leads Monash biographers to write, "Of all the troops in the British EEF Expeditionary Force, only the Australians and the Canadians were capable of winning a constant success." But we can see here there was actual differences. The 4th Army now occupied most of the outpost line overlooking the canal of the main defensive zone, Siegfried Stedel portion of the Hindenburg Line. The northern portion of the outpost line was, however, still in German hands because of the failure of the 3rd Corps. Rawlson offered Monash two American divisions of the 2nd US Corps to replace the exhausted 3rd Corps of two Australian divisions that had captured the outpost. Although administratively the Americans became part of the Australian Corps, becoming the American-Australian Corps, the 2 US Division remained tactically under the command of the Corps Commander, George W. Reed. Rawson trusted Monash with the planning for the main stage and breaking the line. The Hindenburg Line itself, instead of planning the attack out of 4th Army headquarters. This is a compliment to both Monash's proven ability and his knowledge of the ground he captured, and a tribute to the unbroken success of his corps from Amiens on the 8th of August. An analysis of the plan was, and then the varying results of the battle, permitted judgment on the Australian performance. In drawing up the plan to breach the Hindenburg Line, there could be no element of surprise, since the Germans could see that the British held the ridge, and it was obvious that their next move would be on the main position. On the other hand, the British had a map captured earlier that showed the defences had most importantly, the observation observation post the Germans had established. The Germans were still fighting hard as the Third Corps unavailing attempts to capture the northern sector of the outpost line revealed. Although they suffered three disadvantages, weakened morale, lack of reserves because the attacks taking place along the whole front, and increasing shell shortages. Prince's Rupichek's noted the shortage of ammunition for his heavy guns, and by the end of October he reported that half the guns could not be moved by lack of horses. And if the Germans were able to be pushed out of the Hindenburg Line defensive system, the outlook for the continuation of the war was grim.
So, the fact is, the Germans had lost sufficient horses to move things, so if they got pushed back, they lost their artillery.
Montes' plan prescribed a relatively narrow front of attack, crossing the canal with only 600 yards of the tunnel sector, about 5 kilometres. Since the banks to the open section of the canal were too steep and the water too deep to be for an opposed crossing, the infantry attack was preceded by a 3-day preliminary bombardment using gas and high explosive shells in order to cut deep and high belts of wire. Then the plan required the two new untried divisions of the 2nd U.S. Corps to cross over the tunnel, capture and support the line beyond, and turn north and south and widen the breach. Always a difficult manoeuvre, even for experienced troops. Next, the Australian 3rd and 5th Divisions were to leapfrog through the Americans and advance to the Hindenburg Reserve or Bourgeois line. Once the secure bridgehead had been made on the eastern side of the canal, then only the 3rd and 9th Corps could attempt to cross the canal on the north and south of the breach. However, there were several problems with Monash's original plan, which was acknowledged to be somewhat elaborate, and Russell made some changes. First of all, he widened the front of attack because the risk that the German artillery fire to the flanks of Monash proposed SOP. So he ordered the 9th Corps to prepare a crossing of the canal to take place in the south of and at the same time as the Americans and Australians attack. Also, he allocated more time by suggesting the Australians might not reach the reserve line the first day as Monash intended. Indeed, the distance from the starting positions to the outpost line to the first objective for the two American divisions was 4 kilometres, and further objective reserve line was situated 2 to 4 kilometres beyond that. Furthermore, Rawson reduced the role of the 3rd Corps in the operation because it was worn out by its failure to capture the sector of the outpost line. Instead, he gave the greater role to the 2nd U.S. Corps. Monash might have been complimented on his achievements by being asked to produce a plan, but his authority was not such that significant changes were ruled out. Preliminary bombardment began in the early on the 26th of September and continued for 3 days. 750,000 shells were expended. Some were gas projectiles that hampered German movements and caused significant casualties because the defenders had run out of materials with which to produce effective gas masks. Instead of shrapnel, high explosive shells were used with instantaneous fuses were effective in cutting the wire. Munition production had so improved that the proportion of dud shells that arrived had vitiated the efforts of 1915 and 16 was now greatly reduced. And the heavy guns were used to suppress the German artillery, to block entrances to dugouts and machine gun nests, and smash down the sides of the canal to facilitate crossing. None of these advantages belong exclusively to Australian Corps, but were enjoyed by the because the British ships that by 1918 were delivering massive amounts of raw materials, British and American munition factories had produced mountains of guns and shells and used an efficient logistics infrastructure had delivered them to the front in unprecedented volumes. So much for planning and preliminaries. The operation began in the early morning fog of the 29th of September and will be examined in three parts that reflect the three nationalities taking part in the battle. First of all, the northern sector, where the 3rd Corps had originally failed to capture the entire outpost line. The U.S. Division was now complete the capture across the bridge of the tunnel sector. Then the 3rd and 5th Australian Division were to leapfrog the Americans and complete the capture of the tunnel sector and widen the breach. Finally, in the south, the British 9th Corps was to cross the canal over ground. Does the variety of results obtained by the three elements of the attack tell us anything about the Anzac Corps and the myths surrounding their role in the breaking the Hindenburg line? Question mark. In order for novice American doughboys, infantrymen, to reach the designated sight line, namely the old outpost line, they had to complete its capture. This meant that between 26th and 29th of September, they had to push forward as much as a kilometre in some places, as the Australians waited for the preliminary bombardment to do its work of blocking the dugout entrances and suppressing German batteries. Meanwhile, on the Somme River, the 9th Corps practiced the canal crossing using life belts collected from across-channel steamers and rafts made of rubber and reeds. The Americans achieved some success in their attempts to reach the outpost line for the start of the main operation, but the troops were trapped in the forward positions by enemy gunners emerging from behind them. And by the 29th of September, the problem was that there was no accurate information on where all the Americans were placed. If the creeping barrage that had to be fired in front of the advancing infantry on the 29th of September started the outpost line where it had been intended, the Americans, still short of the line, would be too far back to profit from it. On the other hand, if the start of the line of the barrage was brought back, those doughboys who were in possession of parts of the outpost line would be caught in their own barrage. In the event, although Marsh offered to rework the barrage plans, it was decided to stick to the original scheme. So on the first day of the offensive on the main battle position of the Hindenburg line, the guns made by Americans were these. On the left were on the 27th, U.S. Division managed to reach the outpost line, preliminary objective, and some units managed to reach the Hindenburg position. But these units were surrounded by enemies and forced either to surrender or be killed. On the right, 30th U.S. Division was in the fortunate to be in position on the outpost line and so was able to keep close to the creeping barrage. It crossed the main Hindenburg line and reached the fortified village of Norway in the support line. Both divisions suffered heavy casualty, and Rosslyn decided that evening to withdraw the Americans after discussions with the Monash and General Reed. The 2nd U.S. Corps commander, the 27th, had suffered the highest number of casualties with the American formation in a single day in the entire war. The reason for the greater success of the 30th Division over the 27th Division is not difficult to uncover. The Americans had a challenging task, probably too hard for untried troops, in that they were forced to undertake preliminary operations to make good the 3rd Corps' failure to secure the whole outpost line. The former reached the outpost line and so were in position for the main attack on the morning of the 29th of December, whereas the latter, faced particularly strong fortified positions, had not reached its allocated start line, except in some isolated units. Hence, the 27th U.S. Division was unable to keep close to the creeping barrage. It was too far behind it, whereas the 30th Division followed it closely. The results may have been predicted. The Australians in the tunnel sector had the task of leapfrogging the Americans and exploiting the breach in the line. They were hampered by the American failure to subdue those strong points in the outpost line, but eventually made it across the tunnel and captured the 3-mile stretch position and a part of the line. So the Hindenburg line was breached, although Monash had hoped to have punched a wider hole. The Australians were held up as having to deal with unsubdued outpost line, which illustrates how correct Rawson had been to insist that the front of the attack of Monash's original plan was too narrow. In the succeeding days, after hard fighting, the Australians' corps managed to press the reserve Belvoir line. A final attack on the village of Montrebrehan on the 5th of October, in which 2 Australian divisions saw off 3 German divisions, was the last action of the Australian corps. It subsequently withdrawn and took no further part in the fighting. The Australians had been involved continuously since the 8th of August and had taken 23,000 free prisoners from 30 different German divisions and captured 332 guns. In doing so, they suffered over more casualties. 25,000 casualties. So that's pretty amazing. So they, which you expect if you're attacking a defensive position, you'll take more casualties, but there's still a large amount of them. And all the captured guns were actually kept by the Australians, and still in all the little country towns, in the little parks, you'll have a German field gun, and you're given guns of different sizes depending on your population. Finally, on the right, the 9th Corps had the task of crossing the actual canal. rather than going over the top of it, as it passed through the tunnel, as the Australians had done. The artillery bombardment devoted to this task was both extremely heavy and extremely accurate. Nearly the entire heavy artillery of the 9th Corps and 3/5 of the field artillery, together with so field artillery is you're up the front, heavy artillery you're at the back, together with several extra batteries of heavy howitzers were devoted to a single division. The North Midland Division, a territorial unit, which is a reserve unit, that was to cross the canal. The weight of artillery was so effective that the wire on the inner banks of the canal was cut, and the high, steep, brick-clad walls were so broken that the rubble formed ramps for the infantry to descend and climb on either side. In addition, the infantry crossing of the canal began. The barrage supporting them was so intense that the field artillery alone was firing 126 shells on every 500 yards of trench per minute. Oh, dear. Wow, that's a lot. That's bang, 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 bang. That's bang, 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 bang. That's more than tick-tock, dang, dang. That's a huge amount of shells. After 9 hours, 46th Division had captured a fortified village of the Hindenburg positions, as well as the support line. Not only that, a second division of the 9th Corps passed through Meanders and continued through the high ground further east, thus outflanked those German defenders who were still holding up the Australians' advance further north. Even larger segment of the Hindenburg line had been captured, along with 5,000 prisoners. 4,200 were taken by the 46th Division. 90 guns of 72 fell to the same to that same division, which is interesting because the Australians were basically took huge casualties. We don't know what the casualty is. And the 46th Mainland Division was not known for its special prowess, its bronze infantry, its relaxed discipline, or its lack of class and distinctions. These attributes belong in popular imagination to the Australian troops, and they account for the Australian success in such operations and breaking the Hindenburg Line. They differentiate Australians from the less healthy old country conscripts. Indeed, in 1916, the first day of the Somme, the 46th Division had been one of the two divisions in the 7th Corps that carried out the diversionary attack at Gromecourt, north of the main battlefront. The division was cut to pieces in no man's land within 30 minutes. The Corps suffered 6,800 casualties that morning, since the territorial division had been filled with conscripts. Okay, that's interesting. So they're completely wiped out. The Australians still took huge casualties. What then gave the Midlanders success on the 29th of September? This is one of these great things. It's not just one history. You've got next to them, right next to Australia, a more successful British division that had eluded them on the 1st of July 1916. So it's the same people, or worse, but they're more successful. The answer lies in the weight of explosive and gas shells that was first of all battered down the formidable German defences, and second completed the defenders to help keep their heads down to be taken prisoners in such numbers as the infantry advanced, i.e. that's how they took infantry, they took prisoners. Likewise, it was the failure to support the 2nd US Corps with similar weight of shells, so that the 27th Division advanced too far behind the rolling barrage for it to offer any protection against unsubdued strong points in the original outpost line. That accounts for the lack of success and the high casualty rate. The Australians in the middle had a degree of success, but not, in fact, as great as expected, and not as great as the Midlanders. Breaking the Hindenburg Line, with all its associated lines of trenches and high and deep belts of wire, fortified villages and strong points of machine guns, and a deep, wide, muddy canal required a coordinated weapon system. It was not a matter of the world which part of the British Empire or which part of England the infantry came from. The infantry troops formed one element of the weapon system that included tanks, aircraft, and above all, artillery. The guns were made in Britain or Canada with steel imported from the USA. They fired shells packed by women and munition workers. Tanks and aircraft were produced by the British factories. They were not Australian and had no national ANZAC characteristics to distinguish them. The factor that did distinguish the infantry of the Australian Corps, as it did the Canadians, was cohesion. Divisions of the army are the building blocks each containing all services needed to mount the operation. But on the Western Front, a corps was purely an administrative, often temporary, entity. Usually a corps had two divisions, but divisions rotated out of the corps, and the corps itself could be moved between armies. Corps headquarters made sure that divisions liaised with each other, and that the orders and instructions from the armies were transmitted efficiently. In addition, corps oversaw large-scale collective training and controlled heavy artillery. In the French army, by contrast, corps usually had two permanent divisions supplemented by extra units if particular operation required greater infantry resources. In the British Expeditionary Force, therefore, the fact that Australian divisions always served in the Australian Corps and just the Canadian divisions served in the Canadian Corps meant the commanders knew each other, knew the strengths and weaknesses, and trained together and had a literal esprit de corps. When, in August 1918, the Army Council ordered that some battalions in the Australian Division should be disbanded and their men transferred to other battalions so to bring them up to strength, the threatened battalions mutinied. Quote, immediately, they refused to join the new units. Marsh argued for the postponement of the measure until after the Hindenburg operation. A further example of the value of such stability lies in the comment that Monash made about, so Monash is the Australian commander, made about planning for the operation. The corps commanders knew each other so well that that almost of what they said during the conference when he explained, knew each other so well that most of what he said during the conference when he explained his orders of the forthcoming action could be taken for granted. Consequently, the conference lasted mere 75 minutes. By Scottish, Welsh, Irish divisions, as well as those with a strong English regional background, were reinforced with the men as and when they came to hand, irrespective of background. The Australian Corps, by contrast, was as stable, its replacement was also Australian. Yet, too much may be made of such stability. The 46th North Midland Division, for example, was the first territorial unit to arrive in France in February 1915. Suffered between that date and the Australian armistice some 29,559 casualties. That is, it lost more than its divisional strength. I was about to say that. So there have been few men left in November 1918 for the original troop arrived in France in February 1915. Indeed, the Battle of Luz in September 1915, the division had lost the first big attack, nearly half the entire complement of soldiers. And, as noted above, the further bloodletting in the first day of the Somme, unit cohesion cannot have played a role in the success of crossing St. Quentin Canal and the Hindenburg Line. Did the fact that the Australian Corps also commanded by Australians, albeit only since May 1918, and his appointment was contested, make any difference? Although Manchester's reputation gained a boost from the memoirs of the British Prime Minister David Lloyd George, who insinuated Monash, or perhaps the Canadian General Sir Arthur Currie, could have been possible replacements for Douglas Haig as Commander-in-Chief, this was never likely. Lord George was simply continuing his memoirs, his long ongoing battle with his generals, suggesting the possibility that Currie and Monash might have proceed.
Thanks a lot. Can't talk to him. What, hun? Okay, sorry. Are they here? Yeah.
Did Monash was the Australian commander, exhibit in his method of command any particularly Australian characteristics? What differentiated him from other corps commanders? According to Australia's official historian, C.E.W. Bean, which is now, it's been tainted a bit. Colonial officers were less affected by class distinction than their British Army counterparts. They were closer to their men. They enforced discipline through force of character rather than by traditional and distance. However, to the contrary, Monash was quite aloof, very ambitious, and could be ruthless. He had no time for junior officers, although his intermediate collaborators found him friendly and sympathetic. He was more than prepared for the Australian Corps to go back into the line after being withdrawn for a while, despite the strain on his own person. For all the democratic traditions that Bean emphasises, Monash was energetic in seeking foreign decorations, and his accounts of the Australian Corps' achievements were seen by many at the time as propaganda and self-advertisement. So that's interesting that Monash himself was not in the Australian mould. He was actually ex-German. It was his, so he actually spoke German and wrote German to his friends at home. It was his intellectual qualities, his background in engineering and law, that brought him to the fore. In this, he was no different from most other corps commanders in 1918 in the British Expeditionary Force. The average age of the British corps commanders in 29th of September 1918 was 52.6. Monash was 53. By that date, the bulk of British commanders had been promoted on merit from the rank of major or captain at the beginning of the war. Consequently, as John Bourne suggests, they were brought into their command positions where, quote, the training, experience, and instincts of regimental officers, which emphasized personal courage, a high sense of duty, concern, and welfare for the men, and professional attendance to detail, not the least to unit administration. Such comments fit Monash just as neatly. As for the other ranks, even if the notion that Australian soldiers were hardened by life in the bush, healthier and more enterprising than their British counterparts, as by now being exposed as fiction, it was always was, the ill-defined concepts of mateship nevertheless continue to carry weight for some and are invoked frequently as an explanation of Australian success. The value of small group cohesion has long been recognised. In situations of great danger, mutual support and protection are inestimable. That was the British so-called Pals Battalion joined in the Somme in 1916. The entire streets had enlisted together, trained together, and died together. Their mateship was no less strong because it was forged in the streets of Lancaster, middle towns, or among Scottish communities living in Tyneside than was Australian mateship. If it was indeed stronger among the colonials, it was probably a result of the Australian Corps' stability described above. The 30. Into the end here. Sorry, this page is not turning for me. My hands are a bit dry for having been in the pool. 30 US Division on the left of the 29th September 1918 attack was the National Guard Division, recruited mainly from the Carolinas and Tennessee. Surely the commitment of these men to their fellow countrymen was no less than those units alongside. Besides, it was not mateship that enabled the Midlanders to achieve more than the Australians or the Americans. That's amazing. However, much or little committed to look out for each other, and the members of the platoon may be. A shell landing amongst them could kill them or maim them, all without distinction. So Monash was not at all different from his peers in the BEF, and his troops were well equipped and trained as other British divisions. It is important, however, to step back a little from the Hindenburg line. Oh, it's beautiful. Oh, it's a beautiful thing. On the day that the Australians broke the line, the 29th of September, the whole Western Front was on the move. The British and Belgians took back Passchendaele, Messines and Flanders. The French army advanced north to Alet River. The US First Army was pounding away at the Kriemhild Stellung in the Meuse Argonne campaign. In Serbia, the French cavalry reached Kasub. Kaiser Wilhelm agreed with the German High Command that President Woodrow Wilson should be approached with a view of requesting an armistice based on his 14 points. The next day, 30th September, Damascus fell and the Bulgarians surrendered. It was the beginning of the end for the Central Powers. In fact, the fighting was taking place on so many fronts that all at the same time was not simply due to Marshal Foch's orders. Sophisticated logistics solutions played their part too. The safe transfer of 2 million Americans across the Atlantic, the rapid replacement of all material lost in the German spring offensive, the balancing of civilian supply and military needs by a complex system of control and rationing of everything from butter to wheat, coal, zinc, cotton and wool, all these elements contributed to the Allies' victory in 1918. Certainly the Australian Corps broke the Hindenburg Line, but it was not a crucial act. The defensive system extended right across northern France, not simply in the front of the Australians. Germans continued to make fighting retreat before the Fourth Army, and it was the events on the other fronts that participated in the final crisis. Monash's original plan was altered in ways which resulted in the employment of the 46th Division and the successful crossing of St. Quentin Canal. Nor was the Australian Corps the first to break the defensive system. In the tank attacks of Cambrai in November 1917, the Hindenburg Line had been breached. That's a year before. In September 1918, the Canadian Corps and First Army breached it further north, crossing the Canal du Nord and reaching Cambrai before the French Army began its operation. In that, the 4th Army operation and the divisions of the Night Corps achieved more than the Australians on the 29th of September. So, yep, just registering that. Most of all, the very real achievements of the Australian Corps infantry between the 8th of August and the 5th of October, which is much before, could not be have gained without support of mass concentrations of Allied artillery. And this is not to downplay of the Australian performance, it simply puts it into context. Without such perspective, nationalistic mythologies have a nasty habit of obscuring accurate interpretation of the past. I'll just read that last sentence for us Australians.
So there's this view that the Australian First World War soldier was better than the others, and in some, I suppose, narrowly, in some aspects, if you ran them up against, you know, compositions, they might win a few and lose a few. I'll just read the last sentence. Without such perspective, nationalistic methodologies have a nasty habit of obscuring accurate interpretation of the past. And so this is it. This is a way of sidestepping the mythology. They're saying you're having the mythologies, but we don't want to denigrate it or move you off it, but having that mythology means that you can't interpret the past. And I think that's the problem with Australia. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.